Hey guys, it's me from the future. I've already recorded everything, but I figured that you guys needed an explanation. I mean, it's been like a month since we recorded anything at all, and life just got crazy. Like, this corona and stuff hit us, and Norma was graduating at the same time, so we were trying to deal with that too. And all this corona stuff was happening, and everything was going crazy. So our podcast kind of fell down on the totem pole a bit, and Norma was just trying to like find new avenues of ways to express her creativity, and this just turned out to not be one of them, and that's okay. So it's just gonna be me from now on, and I mentioned this and the podcast later, but I just want to apologize to you guys for it being such a long time since the last time you saw me. But I'm back, and I should be recording two, maybe three times a week. But I'm definitely gonna be making up for it, and you'll probably be sick of me by the end of this. So just be prepared for that, and I'll see you guys in my story. Thank you. Hello, and welcome to Satan's Library. This is normally a podcast where we each take a turn and tell our stories, but now it's just me. So this is just going to be Zach's podcast from now on. It's still Satan's Library, but you've just got one host now. No biggie. But let's get right into the story. I apologize if I'm like really sniffly today. I actually spent all day in class outside in 80 degree heat just shooting for work because they sent us to a shooting class. Just to renew our skills and all that. So I'm pretty tired. I actually just fell asleep at 8 o'clock and I woke up like just a few minutes ago. So I'm still like half asleep and the lights are on, but nobody's home, you know? But we will see how well this goes. But like I said, it's just me now. Norma wants to focus on her own thing. I don't think she was having fun anymore doing this, but no biggie. If you want to see her podcast, it's called Normal Journal. That's again Normal Journal, just exactly how it sounds. I will try to link it in the description if you want to view it. But from henceforth, this is all me, baby. But anywho, let's get started. My story today is about the Lizzie Borden murders, and they're actually pretty popular. Like, a lot of people know about it, and this isn't like a tiny story, and it like causes debates today all the time on like whether or not Lizzie Borden killed her parents or like somebody else did or whatever. And there's like so many conspiracy theories on like what happened. So let's just get right into it. So Lizzie Borden was a school teacher, okay? And this is just like the prologue, if you will. Lizzie Borden is a school teacher, and she stays with her stepmother and her father and a maid, and I think her uncle was staying at their house at the time. And their family is pretty wealthy, but her dad is a pretty big penny pincher, and that causes a lot of fights and makes Lizzie and her sister pretty upset pretty often. Because if you've ever been with somebody that like doesn't spend money at all, like ever, even if they have it can be pretty frustrating. Because you're like, why aren't you trying to save money? I mean, you can afford it. Splurge a little. If you ever watched that show about the couponers that like go in there and spend 2 hours giving their coupons to the cash register, I'm sure that's what Lizzie felt like. Anywho, let's start with this story. Early in the morning of August 4th, 1892, the Lizzie Borden house was alive with activity. Though the oldest daughter, Lizzie Borden, slept in, the maid, a respectable Irish immigrant by the name of Bridget Sullivan, served breakfast to the patriarch, Andrew. That was Lizzie Borden's dad, and his wife, Abby. The eldest Borden daughter, Emma, was away visiting friends. That's her sister. Lizzie Borden, an unmarried 32-year-old Sunday school teacher, was the last to join her family. Coming downstairs after her uncle, John Morse, who had arrived unexpectedly for the day before he left the house. Lizzie Borden decided against eating breakfast. Her father, Andrew, decided to go downtown to Fall River, Massachusetts, where the family lived. At the time of the morning, it would be the last time he left his house alive. Sorry. I'm like really dying right now. This is really hard right now. Anyway, we're gonna keep going, okay? Sorry. The Bordens were prosperous, and their patriarch served on the boards of several banks while working as a commercial landlord. In her husband's absence, Abby went upstairs to make the bed where Morse had slept the night before. She would leave the room only one more time, looking for fresh pillowcases. Meanwhile, Andrew had returned home, and the maid let him in, and Lizzie came downstairs, claiming that Miss Borden had left the house after receiving a note saying that a friend was sick and she left to care for them. Lizzie and Emma always referred to Abby, their stepmother, whom they had an unfriendly relationship, as Mrs. Borden, not Mom. Their father believed the story and retreated to his room, where he would remain for only a few minutes before coming back downstairs and settling on a sofa in the living room. Sullivan, who was not feeling well, she reported throwing up that morning, perhaps from the flu that had traveled around the house a few days prior. She went to rest in her room before she fell asleep. According to Sullivan's testimony during Lizzie Borden's trial, she only awoke when Lizzie started screaming that her father was dead. Lizzie Borden later said that she found her father dead, sprawled out on the couch and covered in blood. His face was so badly disfigured that he was unrecognizable. After this screaming, Sullivan ran to fetch the door and... Oh, I'm so sorry. After the screaming, Sullivan ran to fetch the doctor and the neighborhood friend of Lizzie's, but the commotion had attracted the attention of neighbors who had summoned the police. At this point, Abby's whereabouts were still unknown. Lizzie Borden told the gathering crowd of concerned neighbors the same story she told her father, that her stepmother had received a note asking her to leave the house. Lizzie also mentioned that her parents had been ill in the previous days and that she suspected their milk had been poisoned. After returning with the local doctor named Seabury Bowen, Bridget checked for Abby's upstairs, where she found her limp body lying down in a pool of her own blood. Abby Borden had been struck 19 times with a hatchet. Andrew had been hit 11 times with the same weapon. One of Andrew's eyes had been cut in half, and his nose had been completely severed from his face. Abby's blood was dark and congealed, leading to Bowen to believe that she had been killed first. The county medical examiner, Dr. Dolan, looked at the bodies after Bowen. Later, Dolan would have had Borden's stomachs removed and tested. No evidence that the couple had been poisoned was ever found. At first, the police did not suspect Lizzie Borden. After all, she was a spinster from a respected and well-off family, and Lizzie swore to District Attorney Jose Knowlton that she was in the barn looking for a piece of iron when the attacks took place. In the days after the murders, an abundance of clues that all led dead ends confused the investigation even further. A bloody hatchet had been found on a neighboring farm, but it had been used to kill chickens. A man seen wandering around the Borden's property had an airtight alibi for the time of the murders. Even Sullivan was a suspect before the police finally zeroed in on Lizzie. But there were no physical evidence, not even a bloody scrap of clothing, to implicate Lizzie. It was just no one else could have done it. The timeline doesn't make any sense any other way. If Abby was killed early in the morning, the murderer, if it wasn't Lizzie or Sullivan, would have hidden in the house for several hours, waiting for Andrew's return. He or she would have risked being spotted by Lizzie or Sullivan. And what about that note that Lizzie's mother claimed she received? Abby had clearly never made it out of the house, so where was it? Lizzie told her friend, Alice Russell, that her stepmother may have accidentally burned it. Eventually, investigators also discovered that the day before the murders took place, Lizzie had tried to buy prussic acid, otherwise known as cyanide, from a drugstore. But the clerk said that she needed a prescription before she could buy it. That evening, Lizzie visited Russell. In her testimony at the inquest, Russell said that Lizzie was anxious that someone might be threatening her father. She confided that these enemies might want to hurt her family. A few days after the murders, Russell saw Lizzie burning one of her dresses at the stove in her house. When Russell asked why she was destroying the dress, Lizzie said that it was stained and could no longer be worn. After Russell revealed this incident at the inquest, the presiding judge charged Lizzie Borden with the murders. The trial of Lizzie Borden lasted 14 days. It was media sensation. Newspaper headlines screamed, "Lizzie Borden, defense opens." Reporters from Boston and New York crowded the courtroom day after day. They called it the Great Trial. Though Lizzie never testified during the trial, she was still the star of the show. At one point, a piece of tissue paper covering the skull of her father fell to the floor. Lizzie caught sight of the bludgeoned skull and fainted. But presenting the skulls of the murdered Bordens turned out in Lizzie's favor. Her lawyer reasoned that whoever caused such an extreme damage must have been covered in blood after the incident, but Lizzie's clothes were perfectly clean. This has led some to believe that she committed the murders naked. The defense was able to produce witnesses who saw Lizzie leave the barn at the same time of the murders, or who claimed to see strange characters lurking about their property, enough at least to create reasonable doubt for Lizzie's guilt. The defense was also able to have the drugstore clerk's testimony that Lizzie tried to buy poison dismissed on the basis that it was irrelevant and prejudicial. Sorry. Sorry, guys. I'm really struggling still. I'm getting better, though. I'm getting there. I'm getting there. On June 19th, Lizzie was found not guilty of murdering Andrew and Abby. She and her sister, Emma, who inherited her father's estate, bought a house in the fashionable part of Fall River. The sisters lived peacefully at Fall River until 1904, when Lizzie Borden, now calling herself Lizbeth, met an actress named Nance O'Neill. The pair formed a strong bond, but some speculate they were lovers, but Emma did not approve. 2 years after Lizzie met Nance, Emma moved out of the house they shared. Lizzie Borden lived out the rest of her days in relative quiet and privacy before dying in 1927 at the age of 67. She took whatever secrets she had about the murders of her parents to her grave, but that hasn't stopped obsessed followers of her story from forming theories of her own. Some think Andrew's illegitimate son, William, committed the crime, and that Lizzie and Emma conspired to cover up his involvement. Or, more likely, that the two sisters made the plans while Lizzie carried out the actual murders. Others think Lizzie and Sullivan were having an affair and murdered the Bordens together. In 2012, journals kept by Lizzie's lawyer, Andrew Jackson Jennings, were obtained by the Fall River Historical Society. The journals revealed Jennings' direct observation of his client, who history remembers as cold-blooded and callous, but Jennings saw a sensitive side to Lizzie, a woman grieving for her loss. The notebook did not, however, bring the public any closer to knowing who actually killed the Bordens. The murders of Andrew and Abby Borden continue to fascinate the public more than 100 years after the Bordens' acquittal. People continue to flock to Fall River, Massachusetts to visit the site of the murders, which has now been turned into a museum chronicling the history of the murders. Though the tour is entertaining, writes Allison Horrocks in a recent review on the tourist site in New England Today, we are reminded of the horror of the events by well-placed crime photos and a presentation of the murders' sobering facts. It was unsettling to hear of the 19 blows to Abby's head as we stood at the spot where she fell. Some visitors claim that the house is still haunted by the ghosts of Andrew and Abby Borden, and one thing everyone can agree on is that the grisly murders, the sensational Lizzie Borden trial, and the unsolved debate about the true identity of the murderer continues to fascinate as one of America's most notorious murder cases of all time. Thank you, everybody, for joining me. This is my episode for the night. I hope you all have a wonderful night, and I will see you next time.